There are very real barriers that exist for women and for people in different ways, but there's also those ones we can create for ourselves. One of the things that's really important when we talk about organizational culture and leadership is we have to be intentional with paying attention to our employees and that they're all very different. That there's so much hope and possibility, but it all really hinges on courageous leadership. In those still moments, it was really leaning into that I have done a good job. I have served well on the department for 29 years, but my body is telling me that it's time for me to do something different.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Johnny Reddick, retired assistant chief of the California Highway Patrol, and we'll be talking about leadership, safety, and wellness in emergency services. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. On Facebook, we're Respond to Wellness, Inc. We're on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Johnny after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW EMTB. Today, we're honored to be joined by Johnny Reddick. She's a retired assistant chief with the California Highway Patrol. She's a 29-year veteran of one of the largest police agencies in the country with over 12,000 employees. Her job included overseeing large-scale civil disturbance and officer-involved incidents, natural disaster response coordination and oversight, and managing hundreds of personnel within daily operations. She's a graduate of the California Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training, that's POST, the Command College, class number 56, and holds a Master of Science degree from the University of San Diego, USD. She's also an adjunct professor at USD and for San Joaquin Delta College Post Academy. Johnny is a National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, NOBLE, member, and is the current NOBLE National Chair for Safety and Wellness Committee. Johnny, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Yes, welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, Johnny, I'd like to start out by asking you, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you, maybe some experiences as to that contributed to values that, you know, gave you resilience to be in such a high leadership position in law enforcement?
Wow. How much time do we have? you know, when I think about the journey of how I got to where I got to, I would be remiss if I, you know, didn't share a little bit about how I was raised. And I think that builds into our resilience and who we become and who we shape ourselves to be over time. So for myself, I was raised by a single mother, and she struggled with drug addiction, even though she was in a service profession. She was a registered nurse for over 30 years. And off and on, she would work. But when she wasn't working, she was struggling. She was going through her own crisis. And for me as a child, I did not understand that. So for me, I saw that we lived with family. We lived in a room. We lived in Salvation Army. We live in our car. I didn't know where we'd be living. I'd move from, you know, I don't know, two or three different cities or states and go to different schools all the way up till I was probably about 13. And so for me, I had this, my own issues being a young person, right, that we experience either not making friends or looking different, feeling different, and then having, you know, this lifestyle with my mom. And I found sports for me, probably about 12 or 13 years old. And it started giving me something, you know, like discipline and a little bit of structure and, you know, seeing people come together as a team. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. So I continued to play it through high school, but I still struggled in high school. You know, I didn't want to go to different classes. You know, when I look back at my grades, I was like, holy cow, how did I graduate, you know, high school? And when I graduated, I could have went to college, but I didn't really have a mother that said, hey, you need to go to college. So it wasn't mm-hmm. something that I was thinking about. So I decided to get a job at 18 years old as a typist clerk for the county. I worked for the Human Resources Department. And I was, you know, as they tell you, when you get a job with a city, county or state or federal government, you pretty much got a job for life. So, you know, my mindset was thinking I was going to have that job for life. But after a couple of years, I wasn't being challenged. I was starting to see friends that I went to school with coming through getting social services. And I felt like I wanted to do something more, but I didn't know what more was. And there was a huge ad in the newspaper. So the physical newspaper that we used to get. And yeah. It was, you know, apply for the California Highway Patrol. Mm-hmm. And uh-huh. you would get this, you know, salary at the time, but you would get these benefits. And these benefits included, you know, dental, medical, vision, and it said something about a retirement. And because my mother, we didn't have that security, I saw something that might give me security. And so mm-hmm. I was about 20 yeah. and a half, mm-hmm. and I applied. And it was a, you know, quick process because I didn't have much in the background. And I wasn't recruited, though. Mm-hmm. I was not recruited. And even the background investigator at the time didn't recruit me, per se. They told me what the process was and what to expect. And then when I was successful to be able to go to the academy, they just told me when I was going to be going to the academy and kind of how to prepare. But there was no programs to help me do that. And so fast forward, you know, I'm in my career. I'm not really sure what I want to do. There's nobody really speaking into you about that. And mm-hmm. so when I came on in late 1988, you know, December of 88 is when I went through the academy. And so I was out on the streets probably in mid 89 by the time I got done with the academy. Uh-huh. And I didn't promote till I was probably had about 10 years on. And not that I didn't try a couple of times, but there was no mentoring. There was no showing you the pathway on how to do that. And so when you talk about those characteristics and, you know, those things that inspire you and your values, it was really a bunch of trial and error, stumbling along, seeing what other people were doing and saying, if they can, why can't I? But mm-hmm, then I had mm-hmm, to figure out right. the path mm-hmm. to be able to do that. But it really is, at some point for me, I realized it was also my attitude. I had a very bad attitude. I was angry at the world, like all the time. Partly childhood, you know, things that I've gone to therapy for, which has very much enriched my life in so many other ways. But also attitude on feeling like, why does somebody else get something and I don't? And yes, uh-huh. there are very real barriers that exist for women and for people in different ways. But there's mm-hmm. also those ones we can create for ourselves. And so I had to kind of, you know, start moving past my own bad attitude and really kind of seeing how to self-develop, look for opportunities that would grow me, become stronger. You know, that thick skin they talk about. Suck it up, buttercup, which is not necessarily healthy, but that was the era in which I came up in policing.
I'd love to talk a little bit about your promoting through the ranks. And I would share that in my experience, when I was hired as a rookie firefighter, I went to a department that had the first female fire chief in the state of Connecticut. And so I was a new guy, not really, you know, in a position to speak up, but I saw things, I heard things, and I witnessed things that in terms of pushback and resistance and, you know, the challenges of being a female in a position of leadership and authority that really, in a way, were disturbing. And I just wanted to touch on your rise through the ranks in law enforcement. You kind of broke through a ceiling that's very, very stratified, I guess is the right word, for women of color and executive leadership. And to me, that's an inspiring accomplishment. So what was that promotion process like for you? And did you have any mentors or strategies?
Well, thank you for that. And I appreciate you sharing your own experience and what that was like for you, because sometimes, and we kind of chatted before we went live here, some people are very unaware what somebody else's experience could be in the very same room, the very same incident, the very same conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's really important when we talk about organizational culture and leadership is we have to be intentional with paying attention to our employees and that they're all very different. Despite our cultural background, our gender, just socioeconomically, maybe we all get a police salary, but you don't know how I'm living. You don't know what my experience is personally before I get to work. And so we have to pay attention to our people, because if not, we can begin to, you know, make them feel, you know, not included or maybe not worthy. There's a lot of things that we carry from baggage from our childhood. And you know, we have clinicians and people who are much better at that. And for me, when I was looking at my leadership ascension, the biggest thing that I found for myself and that I found with many people that I actually coach or work with, and also while I was coming up through the Hire Patrol when I was doing study groups for them, is just understanding the process. Like, what is this process for me to promote? What do I need to do? Leadership and taking an exam, a promotional exam, are two very different things, but they should be one thing, right? So we can all kind of game the system and learn the process and make a promotional list. And then based on the way civil service exams work or, you know, selections are made, you can be promoted. But this part of building your leadership acumen along the way is something we think we're doing, but we're not necessarily doing it just because we may be doing the job. And so I thought for many years, because I was doing the job, that when I wanted to promote to sergeant, that that would automatically translate into leadership. And two things happened. One is it didn't translate into either in the sense of what I wanted. I had to take the sergeant's exam three times because I did not understand how to study, what to study, and how to pass a written test for knowledge on policy. And then the other part of that is your oral interview and how to be able to come in and communicate and convey your knowledge now in this process. And then once you actually get promoted, you're leading other people. You're responsible for others. It's not just being risk managers and making sure people are kind of compliant. You are a caregiver pretty much for those that are under your umbrella of responsibility. And so my sergeant kind of process for me became an aha. And at the same time, I had two small children while I was trying to study and prepare. And that started maturing me, right? Responsible for kids, being married and all that.
Right.
But when I gained the team of actual people who needed me in a different way, it really made me start thinking about what kind of leader do I want to be? Do I want to be a leader that just has power and authority? Or did I want to be a leader that perhaps is transformational, can be authentic, can really help people find their best selves along the way. And so that was really my reason for continuing to promote. Of course, there's always the incentive of being able to have pay and, you know, a few other luxuries that come along with it. But what I realized is it also gave me the influence to be able to help others achieve the things that they wanted to achieve, but also to give them voice in the rooms that I got to go to that they don't get to go to. Mm-hmm. And then in that same vein, ones that I was never in, now I get to be in. And that's kind of how I look at my ascension up.
How was that for you, Johnny, as a woman?
Awkward sometimes. Because
Why was that?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I had talked about seen and unseen barriers, the very real barriers that exist and those that we can create for ourselves. And it's a male dominant profession, as we know, policing, yep. steeped very much in, gender roles and stereotypes and, you know, how women should be or shouldn't be. And so for us as women, when we come into those rooms, we already have some kind of self-limiting feelings and behaviors of our own. Some of us, not all of us. Mm-hmm. And we may not have the confidence. We also may not have the competence all the time in the right areas. And I only say that because I know I had to grow my knowledge to be able to be more confident, to be able to speak on topics versus just from my feelings and my emotions. I had to now start applying more of what we call today evidence-based, approaches. Mm-hmm. Right. But then you also have men who would be in those rooms and they would have power dynamics. And, you know, I recall one of my chiefs, she was a 2-star chief and I was her sergeant at the time. And I was overseeing statewide programs for the entire Highway Patrol for recruitment, community outreach, large budget, large oversight. And we went up to see the commissioner of the Highway Patrol and he was in the room and he had several other fellow chiefs in there. And she had an appointment to be there, but she went to the office door and he just dismissed her like, I'll be with you in a few, have a seat out in the lobby. And now I'm with her because I'm going to be offering the subject matter expertise on this particular topic when we go in to present it. But she didn't bat an eye. She, in her uniform, took a seat and we waited. And we waited a long time. Mm-hmm. And you could hear them laughing, not talking about business. And it was kind of another moment for me to say also how to keep your composure in those situations versus losing your composure and it could all be bad. And so I just took that moving forward that when I was in those rooms, I would be an observer. Mm-hmm. Really listening carefully, right. And then being careful when I chose to speak mm-hmm. and when I spoke about things, because it would be like E.F. Hutton. I don't, some of our generational people may not know that E.F. Hutton commercial that women spoke, familiar. Everybody like leaned in. But when I chose to actually share something, I was just very careful and thoughtful. And I think over time, I built a reputation for myself. That was a good reputation. That was one of somebody who was not only contemporary, but also somebody who was looking out on the landscape and forecasting and looking at things and implications of what might be or could be. And what are we doing now? And, how are we protecting ourselves from civil liability through risk management, also leadership development and, taking care of our people while being responsive to all the demands that we have. Mm-hmm.
If I can share my experience and help just one person or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
So you have an amazing experience and perspective through this career trajectory that you have. Maybe you can talk to how you did this as a officer, as a chief. How do you empower women to rise within the law enforcement profession?
Wow, you gave me chills with that question, David. You gave me chills. I mean, for one, I feel like because I have been through the experience as a woman in policing and a woman of color, I can speak to many different things when I'm speaking to women or with women. And one of those is just really modeling the way. I mean, a lot of times, of course, we have to assimilate to our environments and a culture, but it doesn't mean that we have to surrender completely who we are as women in that. Mm-hmm. And so just encouraging women to be self-aware. Mm-hmm. And I say self-aware that you're also doing things that might limit your ability to demonstrate your leadership, demonstrate your commitment. Mm-hmm. Just because we have families and we have this work-life balance doesn't mean we're any less committed than our male counterparts. Mm-hmm. It just means we have to maybe demonstrate it differently. And we have to understand that that's okay. Because sometimes women will opt out of choosing to promote because they feel like they have those obligations or other priorities and they don't want to unbalance that. And I commend you for that because I can't say that I did that well. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you what I did that worked for me was to understand that there are two people in a relationship. Whoever your significant other is, there's two people in that relationship, and you should have good communication so that you can both achieve the things that you're desiring to achieve. And will there be sacrifices? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it cannot be lopsided. And then when I speak to women about what are you doing in your career to ready yourself for promotion, you know, what kind of assignments are you seeking out? Don't get stuck or pigeonholed into assignments that are just usually the ones they give us women, which can be recruiters or, you know, outreach or, you know, sometimes something administrative and inside, which we can learn a lot while we're there. But if you want to be on the SWAT team or you want to be an emergency vehicle operations instructor, have the confidence to put in for it, but also prepare for it. Mm-hmm, what does it take to be it?
Right.
If you want to promote, you have to put in for the examination. You have to study and prepare. If you want the assignment, you have to be ready for it. And so I try to work with women not only on mindset, because there's a lot of deep rooted things that we feel when we're unworthy or we feel that, you know, we're not confident or competent. We can minimize ourselves in spaces. We can have automatic negative thoughts that really just rattle our cage. But there's also this part about preparation. What are you really doing in your inventory of work to prepare yourself? And then how are you showing up, you know, in that examination or in that new assignment or whatever that may look like? So there's a whole barrage of things when I think about helping women, and we have great organizations out there working towards that 30 by 30 initiative to have, you know, 30% women by 2030. And so there's really great work being done right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So back over to on the leadership topic, you know, what factors, personal qualities, attributes that you feel are most valuable to be an effective leader?
So for one, I think you need to have compassion. Mm-hmm. I think compassionate leadership is one of those things that we underestimate the value of it. There's importance in having a level of emotional intelligence. And, you know, understanding our own emotions, but also how we interact and engage with others. I think communication, we see that on, you know, exam bulletins or listed have good communication skills. But what does that mean? What does communication take when we when we look at organizational culture and how we're communicating? I can't tell you how many times that I hear from my students at the University of San Diego that go through, you know, our law enforcement and public safety leadership master's program. Now, these are, you know, from executives, middle managers, to detectives sometimes that are in our classes. It's simple communication from those that are above them to just share with them what is going on in the organization. We're not talking about the community wanting to know. We're talking about internal communication in organizations where you create transparency with your own people, where if you don't know, let them know you don't know, but it's okay to communicate with them that you don't know and have that interaction and engagement. So I think we minimize the importance of communication and how impactful that can be. And then also, I think it's important for us to have this level of trustworthiness so that you can create, to me, the level of relational. We talk about outwardly relational policing, right? Having relationships with the community and build. But we need to have this relational aspect for procedural justice internally in our organizations. And so you need to be a trustworthy leader. You know, and that means if you're saying one thing and doing something else, that's going to have an unintended consequence more than likely. So, you know, your people are want to be able to trust you and come to you and share with you things, but also glean things off of you and from you. So if you, like I said, I hate to like beat a dead horse, but if you are not aware or comfortable or know something, let them know. They want to see the human experience in you too. We don't have to always show up like we know everything. And I think that's what helps people see themselves in being a leader or being able to help other people, is to say, okay, well, I see myself there. That might be, you know, something I can do. And so, you know, those are just a few things on top of, you know, being decisive, having good judgment, being a problem solver, but these are the human aspects of things.
The human aspects. Do you feel that that piece might be missing? I mean, if there's anything with leadership and how it is right now, what would you say? Would you say that those are the qualities that are missing? The transparency, trustworthiness, compassion, communication. That's the list that I made.
Yeah. You know, and I wouldn't say that they're missing completely. I would say that we, that leaders are so pressurized to perform, depending on all your levels of leadership. You're just in this pressure cooker to perform all the time. Right. And so you can stray away from this space of being very intentional that matters to those people that you're working with and around. And so what's missing is the intention to remember that even though my boss is coming to me and they want the numbers, and the numbers could be whatever you're overseeing. They want the numbers because they want to see the results.
Right.
That just because that pressure is happening to you doesn't mean we forget how to treat our people. Because our people right now, and they have been, it's just that it's more amplified now, are experiencing so much trauma, so much, you know. But the pandemic is just something that exacerbated everything to me, really. But they're experiencing so much that they're bringing to work that they don't need to feel that at work, too.
Right.
There's a difference of holding somebody accountable for some misconduct, right? And these egregious things. But people are going out working short-staffed. They're working long hours. And we still got to get the numbers. But we have to understand that we're working with people. And you can get so much more from them if we look at those leadership competencies and qualities that I talked about, that they'd be willing to work for you, you know, 48 hours straight if their body physically could, because you're that type of leader. But when you're not, these folks, they don't want to do it.
The leader earns the respect of the constituents. I think that sometimes it's almost too much expected the other way around, and where the leader is more so cracking the whip and more the disciplinarian and wanting to keep the department out of the newspaper for, you know, complaints and issues happening with the police and almost to a, you know, in excess, and where that compassionate piece, okay, well, what might my officers be going through right now?
Right. And how can you help them?
That might just not be, it's not being taken as seriously as like, 'cause you're presenting how important it is.
Yeah. How hard is it for us to take time to look at their workload, for example?
Yes.
Just because this has been their workload the way it's always been, doesn't mean that it can't be redesigned or restructured. And that's a one of the challenges in law enforcement and public safety culture is because we've always had the same structure, the same approach, the same design, that it took forever for us to even look at shift schedules, to look at those and doing something that was different. And now those alternate work weeks look different, but maybe we need to relook at alternate work weeks to actually, instead of it looking at a week, what does a day need to look like? So for example, I had someone talk about, you know, they were signing up for overtime, but they couldn't sign up for the full 4-hour block. So they just don't sign up at all. But yet they need people to go out and work, say, recruitment or outreach. Mm-hmm. But how about redesigning what an overtime block looks like? Why does the, you know, the unions and management have to be so rigid that it has to be 4 hours or 8 hours or 2 hours? Why can't it be, if they can work 90 minutes, why can't they work 90 minutes? You know, because they want to participate, but they can't give you four, or they can't give you. And so that's a small example. But if we just relook at redesigning things and meeting people where they are versus trying to keep making them meet us inside the box, man, we might be surprised what we'd come across if we just kind of, you know, blew that up a little bit.
As an officer, a leader within a department, you now have the charge of your members, your rank and file, and not only the numbers, but just getting the calls done with increased call volume, with increased requirements for training, and the amount of time and space left over to focus on the well-being of your members kind of diminishes, right?
Yeah.
That's the biggest challenge I found as an officer, was to find that time and space to be present for them, right? To really just take a moment and check in on them, because there's so many other things going on in a shift that needed to be accomplished. So,
and we put so much on a supervisor. They're a linchpin. We use all these cool, terms. They're the link, the linchpin. But man, how are we equipping them to really be helpful to the people that they're leading? And you mentioned training, and there's so much training that's required, for us to stay in compliance and, make sure that we're following guidelines. But we spend, in most post academies and post, for us in California, it's very limited on those interpersonal, emotional intelligence, those people engagement kind of skills that they need, but also increasing this ability for them to deal with their employees who are in crisis. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be the clinician because we have resources and services. Most agencies and many don't. They're still building their programs out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they don't know how to have that kind of uncomfortable conversation with their employees. They also don't like conflict with their employees. Mm-hmm. So when we have avoidance and we're not dealing with those things manifest into other things. And this is still about caring for your employees. And so we don't train them well for that. We get all this extra great leadership training when we kind of get above a lieutenant, but we really get it more so when we're above a commander. We go to FBI and AA, we go to command colleges, we get leadership institutes, we go to all kinds of stuff. But our first line supervisors maybe get 80 hours of training. And then where's their refresher training? Where's their continual training that helps them to be able to do a good job?
Yeah, great point. Great point. Love to shift gears and talk about your book, Black, White, and Blue, Surviving the Sifting. What inspired you to write it? And what do you hope people take away from reading it?
Well, it was a... passion project that was in my heart for decades. Based on my identity, I'm half Black, I'm half white. And also as blue, being in law enforcement, for almost, you know, for 29 years. And so the title, kind of spoke to me in that way. And then surviving the sifting, I'm a woman of faith, and that sifting process of, removal of all those things like, wheat from the chaff so that you can get to, I don't know, this great place where you can really enjoy life. You don't have to feel guilty anymore. You don't have to feel ashamed. You can look at your past and see the beauty in the ashes, so to speak. But within it, it's my leadership journey of, you know, the different trials and tribulations as a woman, going through my police agency, but also dealing with things as a woman, as a mother, as a wife. You know, as a daughter, you know, and the loss that you have, and in those leadership dark moments that you experience. And so to me, it was writing about this human experience. And I know we use the behind the badge, but it wasn't a behind the badge, because my whole life really is an integration of all of those things. So there shouldn't be a front and a back. There shouldn't, it's all of who I am. And how it wasn't easy, but it's possible. And so I thought that was really important to be able to write and be vulnerable enough where the book wasn't just for people in blue, it was for people. So that when you read it, those experiences can inspire you, give you hope, but also kind of give you some strategies on how to look at things or approach things when we're talking about leadership. And then, of course, the end of the book, I wanted to add a little bit in the closing outside of my personal story through my leadership about the law enforcement landscape that we're in now, that there's so much hope and possibility, but it all really hinges on courageous leadership, you know, being a part of that change versus being a part of the complaining or, you know, being a part of just status quo. Status quo is not good enough. And so that's really what my book is about. And, you know, and I'm really proud of it, but it was really hard to do.
Is there a particular story that stands out where, you know, you there was a learning curve for you where, you know, you sifted through the choices that you had made and then rose above and prevailed? Is there a particular story that you'd like to share to give us an example of the book?
There's so many for my personal life, but the one that was a big for me was the end of my career. So for us in law enforcement and public safety, you know, we have a very wonderfully blessed retirement system, especially for us in California. And I wasn't necessarily planning on retiring, but I went through a health issue, and it is part of that cumulative trauma that we have through our work that unfortunately will catch up to us at some point. And during those silent moments, I just wanted to keep doing the work. I was an assistant chief responsible for a lot of things. I was projected to promote again. I had just done the, you know, exam, did well, you know, all of this horizon was looking bright to keep going, but I wasn't feeling well. And the sifting process for me was really being still long enough versus the phone ringing 24/7, the emails coming in, all the crisis incidents. Every time the phone rings, it's not to say, hey, it's a great thing happening. It's always something. Somebody is, you know, injured, killed, something's being, you know, disturbances and protests. And so in those still moments, it was really for me saying and leaning into that I had done a good job. I have served well on the department for 29 years.
Right.
But my body is telling me that it's time for me to do something different and to end something that's been a part of my life since I was 21 years old. And it was a very hard experience, but I was hospitalized several times during the end, and I had a lot of quiet time. And in one of those moments. It just, I allowed myself really to kind of surrender to it. And once I did, and I actually spoke it out loud to, you know, my husband and my children, and I was worried about their reaction, but they just cried because they were like, it's about time. You know, and then when I told my, you know, my commissioner that I was going to retire, and they kept, are you sure? You can take time off. You can, you know, and, but when I told them how I felt and why I was doing it, they surrendered to it too and congratulated me. Wow. And that just allowed me to take the weight off of what I've been carrying for so long. And to get there and to allow yourself to say it's okay. Man, that was a big sifting process for me because I was trying to hold on like I needed to, and but my body was saying, we can't, you know. And sometimes I think for a lot of us, it's scary to retire when you've been raised by an organization for almost three decades, you know. So,
well, thank you for sharing that.
It's a great story.
Yeah, amazing. And ties into so many conversations we're having about retirement or ending the chapter of being in emergency services. So just to wrap up, love to have you just speak to your coaching that you do out there. What do you do? How do you do it? And who's the community that you work with as a coach?
Oh, thank you. So I do promotional preparation workshops. And I usually work with individuals, but recently I've actually had a couple of associations that have come to me and asked me to do some actual group workshops for some of their members, which was kind of cool. I enjoyed that. So I help people prepare for, you know, their written part of their exam, that interview portion of their exam, but also looking at their inventory of work and how they want to look at any kind of resumes they have. Additionally, looking at their own readiness, right? We just talked about, you know, when you get ready to promote, how ready are you? You know, when the bulletin comes out, isn't the time for you to be prepared. But I actually walk them through how to actually look at policy, study policy. I, you know, help them with mechanisms to be able to retain information for them when they're doing the written test, when they're, you know, going to their oral interviews. I actually wrote a book on that. Survival Guide to Law Enforcement Promotional Preparation. Wow. It was designed, again, because I'd done so many study groups when I was in the higher patrol. And then I started doing it after I retired that I was like, why don't I just put some of these great strategies and ideas in this little guide or book?
Yeah.
And it's for everybody because I just made it law enforcement, but it applies to anybody who's looking at promotional preparation. And so that's the majority of my consulting. That is what I really love to do most when I'm coaching. And I do some coaching individually for individuals who need that extra level of personalization for them. But the workshops, I love doing that. And then, of course, I love being a professor at the University of San Diego and also at the local junior college here, the San Joaquin Delta Post Academy. So that's where all of you know, people interested in law enforcement come through our cadet program. And I teach over there in leadership, ethics, and also they do a cultural immersion project with me for, you know, almost 40, 41 hours. We work through that so they can have better community engagement. And it's the first one. I mean, we really don't do that in those post academies. So I'm just grateful they allowed me to be a part of that and be a part of developing that.
Wow. Amazing stuff. And I think the word retirement certainly does not apply to you.
Well, no. Well, so we had talked a little bit about that. So it's a second season, right?
Second season. Yeah. I like that.
To decide how you really want to set the cadence for your life and how you want to contribute, you know, to be able to provide the balance and still, you know, feel connected. And so lastly, I just want to add that I'm also, you know, for NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, which I've been a part of for over two decades. They are an organization that really is about justice, you know, by action and getting involved and bridging the gaps in social justice issues. But for us in public safety and law enforcement, they also bridge what we're missing in our agencies. So they do leadership development and mentoring and education and training. And so I love that I get to be a part of that in the safety and wellness committee. So, I love the balance because I still get to spend time with my grandson, who's two, and all of our adult children. We have five of those. We have a blended family, but I'm just grateful.
Thank you, Johnny, so much for sharing that. For those who are interested, how can people find you out there on the internet or social media?
Well, my name, Johnny Reddick. If you just Google me, I pop up, believe it or not. Which is beautiful. I've had many opportunities to have speaking engagements. And that will pop up. My website is jlconsultingsolutions.com. But yeah, if you just, Google my name and please connect with me on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I try to share content that's, I think important and hopefully touches and reaches people. And I love to support people on my platform as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much again for being with us and sharing all of this. There's so much to the leadership piece just by itself. And certainly your story, your accomplishments and what you're doing now moving forward are all super inspiring. So thank you for being with us and sharing that.
Yeah, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Please check out our YouTube channel. It's Respond to Resilience. We're happy to have you subscribe there. Our Facebook page is Respond to Wellness, Inc. We are on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com with all the past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.